LA, and we talk about that every episode.
Just do it!
I donated my car to KPFK, called 877-KPFK-AUTO. They took it away. Tax deduction. Anyone can have their car taken away. Cars, boats, motorcycles, any fossil fuel vehicle. Leaf blowers, not a vehicle. Call 877-KPFK-AUTO. Donate your car to KPFK. Help the station. And commute by bike. There's no traffic on a bike.
This is Saul Williams, and I'm a proud supporter of KPFK because it supports our community.
Don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you are too arrogant. And if you don't change your ways, I will rise up and break the backbone of your power.
Habari Ghani, we come in peace within the framework of justice. This is Sister Thage with Freedom Now, a Saturday Pan-Africanist and Internationalist World Affairs program. Freedom Now is rooted in the principle of the rights of all peoples and nations to self-determination. Hence, we combat the 1%. We provide the microphone for the 99%. And today, our agenda for this Saturday, September 7, 2024, we commence with our sister, Luyanda Kuboka, in the African drumbeat historical calendar. Then, prolific author, radical historian, professor of African American studies at the University of Houston, and Freedom Now co-producer, Dr. Gerald Horn interviews Erica Denise Edwards, associate professor of history at the University of Texas, El Paso, and author of the book Hiding in Plain Sight, Black Women, the Law, and the Making of a White Argentine Republic. And later in the hour, Dr. Horn interviews Lee Fott, associate professor of history at Le Moyne College in Syracuse, New York, and author of the book Sally Hemings, Given Her Time. We'll also hear from political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal read his message of solidarity to water defenders by Leonard Peltier. Leonard Peltier is a Native American activist and member of the American Indian Movement who was convicted for the deaths of two FBI agents who died during a 1975 shootout on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. We also want to announce that this week, the California Black Caucus blocked a key reparations bill in Sacramento. So there was an emergency town hall meeting this week in Limerick Park, Africatown, organized by our brother Billion Godson with the Africatown Coalition and Blackshin 365. They also discussed updates on art and practice in the village gentrifying Limerick Park, Africatown. Save Sikas. Please contact the Reparation Collective at gmail.com for more updates and community meetings, or follow on Instagram Africatown Coalition or the page Fight to Save Black LA. That's with the number 2, Fight to Save Black LA on Instagram. Our music clip mix includes MLK, Zap Mama, Native American and Ocean Waves for Water Protectors, Joel Ross, George Benson, Makaya McCraven, Wes Montgomery, and more. So sit back, phone a friend, and as always, we stand ready for revolution.
Alafia to our KPFK listening audience. I'm Sister Luyanda Kuboka with our weekly African drumbeat historical calendar for this week, September 5th. The recent human crisis in the Middle East demonstrates the critical need for us to learn from the successful struggles of bygone eras. We need to map out our future as African people and the poor and oppressed by building on the successful revolutions that have characterized humanity. Hopefully, the following struggles will provide a dark light in the sea of white blinding racism, which is at the fundamental foundation of U.S. society. September 5th, 1905. Africans leave Oklahoma and immigrate to the remote area of northern Alberta, Canada, seeking freedom from the segregation and lynchings in the United States. September 5, 1877. Crazy Horse, whose traditional name among the Lakota Native Americans is Tashunka Oitko, was one of the greatest Native American resistance leaders. Through an alliance by marriage with the Cheyenne, they defeated numerous U.S. Army forces in battles in the Black Hills, Little Bighorn, and throughout Wyoming. Tashunka Oitko Crazy Horse was never defeated in any war with the U.S. military. September 6, 1912. Ella Gray was born in Tallapassa County, Alabama. She was a socialist organizer among Southern sharecroppers. At the age of 19, she became a leader of the sharecropper union and organized the Young Communist League. In spite of armed attacks by local police and the murder of family members, she held the sharecroppers union together, fighting the exploitation by large farm owners. September 6, 1966. J.A. Rogers, Pan-Africanist historian and field anthropologist, crosses over. J.A. Rogers, a self-trained historian from Jamaica, was a Pullman porter on the railroad. He never finished high school. Rogers, when visiting various cities, would pay white Pullman conductors to go to the segregated libraries and take out books for him. Rogers also visited over 60 countries doing field research and writing articles about the conditions of African people worldwide. According to W.E.B. Du Bois, no man living has revealed so many important facts about the Negro race as has Rogers. Rogers published over 16 books, his most important being From Superman to Man, 100 Amazing Facts About the Negro, The Real Facts About Ethiopia, and World's Great Men of Color. September 6, 1972. La Raza Unida Party holds its first national convention in El Paso, Texas. La Raza Unida Party is the oldest progressive Chicano party in the United States. September 7, 1885. Jovita Ida De Juarez was born. Jovita was a Chicano journalist and fighter for Chicana and women's rights. With her newsman father and two brothers, she launched a vigorous investigation and demonstrations against the racist lynchings of Chicanos. Her family newspaper, La Cronica, was an early voice for social justice and equality. They fought white assimilation and promoted cultural pride, brown pride. She founded the Mexican Feminist League in 1911. September 7, 1974. Frelimo, Front for the Liberation of Mozambique, the African Socialist Liberation Movement, defeats the Portuguese and U.S.-backed attempt at a coup d'etat over the People's Democratic elected government. September 8, 1881. Helen Disha was born. Helen was a prolific Hawaiian composer, singer, and dancer who fought Euro-Christian missionaries as cultural imperialists as they banned native Hawaiian music and dance, including the hula, as being savage and bestial. September 9, 1948. The Korean People's Democratic Republic was founded. North Korea, one of the many socialist revolutions which characterized the post-colonial period. Today, North Korea maintains a staunch socialist political economic posture in the face of the United States and Western Europe's continued efforts at destabilization. September 9, 1882. Sarah Mapps Douglas, an African sister born in the United States, a teacher, abolitionist, and early member of the Free African Society. Sarah opened one of the first schools in Philadelphia in the 1820s, despite racist threats and violence. Sarah continued to teach young African girls in the Institute for Colored Youth, which she took charge of in 1853. September 10th, 1979, Agostinho Neto, leader of the MPLA, Movement for the Liberation of Angola, crosses over to the ancestor world. MPLA was a vanguard African popular movement which led to the defeat and subsequent decolonization of the Portuguese. September 10, 1974, Fatima Boiro crosses over. She was a guerrilla fighter and a leader in the PAIGC, the Revolutionary Liberation Movement for Guinea-Bissau, against Portuguese colonialism. Fatima joined the PAIGC after escaping from a forced marriage to a 73-year-old man when she was 19 years old. She helped architect the PIGC, banning of forced marriages in the new revolutionary Guinea-Bissau. This has been Sister Luyanda Koboka here on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live worldwide at www.kpfk.org. And in the voice of our ancestors in Azania, South Africa, we say Amandla Awetu, Amandla Awetu, Amandla Awetu.
For Pacifica Radio, KPFK, this is Gerald Horn, and with me on the line is Lee Thought, Associate Professor of History at Lemoyne College in Syracuse, New York, and author of the book, Sally Hemings, Given Her Time. Thank you for joining us on Freedom Now, KPFK Los Angeles, Lee Thought.
Thank you. Thank you for having me speak about this book. It is quite a pleasure and an honor.
And it's a pleasure and honor to have you. So who was Sally Hemings and why did you decide to write a book about her?
Well, Sally Hemings, the most neutral way I can put it is she was a woman who was enslaved by Thomas Jefferson and gave birth to seven of his children, also enslaved, four of whom lived to adulthood and eventually became free. I honestly never saw myself writing a book about her. My specialty was more Frederick Douglass, whom I adore. But a couple of things happened. First of all, I was supposed to be working on one of two other projects, one of which I'm still supposed to be working on. But I had been teaching a U.S. History Survey course, and it was for the first time at Lemoyne, I had almost entirely women in my course and almost entirely women of color. And I usually incorporate Sally Hemings, you know, in my lectures, and they were very interested in her. And so I suggested they read Annette Gordon Reed's amazing Hemingses of Monticello. But if you're familiar with the book, it's got like 600 pages of text, and they decided hard pass. So I thought, gosh, somebody really needs to write a short book about Sally Hemings, just, you know, a biography of Sally Hemings to assign to a survey level class, because they really need to know about this woman. She really encapsulates a real story of America's founding. But, you know, that was just a thought. And then that winter, Carol Birkin, who edits a series on the lives of American women, contacted me and said, would you like to write it? And I was kind of trepidatious about it because, like I said, I do a little later period of time. And I was supposed to be working on other things. And but I just thought it'd be fun to tell my mother, who had always been a really big fan of Sally Hemings before, you know, historians were on it. She had read Fawn Brody and just loved Sally Hemings. And she said, do it, do it. And so I agreed to do it. I figured it'd be really easy. I actually thought I was just doing basically the cliff notes for Annette Gordon Reed. And it turned out that I actually ended up disagreeing with Gordon Reed on a couple of things, but it just became so fascinating. It was actually, I look back now, in an act of complete audacity on my part. And I kept saying that to myself as I kept, you know, I just kept, the more and more I wrote on her and researched her, the more it felt that way. But I also, the more and more I was convinced, people absolutely need to know about her. every bit as much as they need to know about Thomas Jefferson. And so it was hard to just keep it so short, so that people would want to read it. So that's really how it came about.
Hmm. Now, the stock of Thomas Jefferson, the third U.S. president, has fallen precipitously in recent decades, part of it having to do with this intimate relationship with teenage Sally Hemings when he was 44 years old. How do you assess that in your book?
Well, okay, without getting into too much detail so that you'll have the reason to read the book. First of all, one thing I found in a chapter that did not make it in the book, which was following her story after she had died, how the story evolved in the public memory, was his stock has risen and fallen throughout history as well. It's not just recently, but a lot of it had to do with the Democratic Party. But that's a whole other story. But yes, his stock should fall a lot because of this, and not just because she was so young, but because it was a completely exploitative relationship. And because, not just because it was he enslaved her, but the way he approached all of his enslaved people they were not full human adult beings to him. And with her, the way that's been written about, even among historians, it's like she stepped off of the boat from America and he pounced on her. It wasn't quite like that. It was much more subtle than that. And I don't believe it was a love story either. I don't believe that he was in love with her or anything like that. When I started to follow it day by day, not literally day by day, but when I started to kind of get down into Paris and her being there, and what the records revealed about her being there or didn't reveal about her being there, and what's going on in the streets in Paris, and what the layout of their house in Paris looked like, and how servants behaved, and how he treated the enslaved servants or the not enslaved servants in Paris, and what was going on with her brother James, who himself is incredibly fascinating, and who I kind of tend sometimes to fall in love with the characters, with the people I'm researching, and he was so amazing. He was being trained to be the chef, and by the time she showed up, he had reached like the height of his training, and I came to the conclusion that what most of the historians were envisioning was that she arrived and then she was just there doing nothing, hanging around the house. And that's not how Thomas Jefferson operated. So my suspicion is that she got hired out for most of the time she was in Paris. And then towards the end of their time there, when she's about 16, she comes back to the house to be the lady's maid to his daughters, especially the older one, who was called Patsy, Martha, who became Martha Randolph. And that's when he starts making his moves on her, because the way the houses operated, there was no reason she would be in the room alone with Jefferson unless he made it happen. So this was even a literary genre at the time. It was in all of, the seduction tale, where the master basically corners the female servant. And this is just, part of the stories, and makes it so she can't say no, and thus takes that to mean she consented, even though she didn't consent. And so it meant going into what a lot of these seduction stories, and I say seduction because that's a language they use, it was just basically cornering a young woman to the point where she had no choice. And that alone is pretty sleazy. It was sleazy then, but it was also just kind of accepted the way sleazy things were accepted. And so that, and he was doing this at a time when he knew he was going to return. He didn't want all of the upset of, an emotional relationship, and he wanted access to sex for his health so he could keep his humors in balance, which was the kind of the way of keeping your mental health in balance at the time, the prescription for health at the time. And so she was there, she was convenient, he had absolute power over her and her family. So that alone was just, it was exploitative of her. And because she was so young, it was much easier for him to do that.
Now, you mentioned that they were in France together. This was at a time when he was an envoy from yes. North America to France. Possibly she could have left him, abandoned him in France. Why didn't she?
Yes. In fact, one of the things I don't think many of the other historians really took seriously was her brother, James. But the two of them, I think, operated together a lot. And I think the two of them, I kept thinking about how the environment, the two revolutions worked together, because they were there. And I started looking at the dates of when they were there. They were actually there when the Bastille fell. And that happened right before they left. And I looked at where their house was, where all of these riots were. And one of the most chilling pieces of evidence I found that was just like, it's one of those pieces where it's like, oh my gosh, you know, that you come across pieces of evidence like that where you're like, oh God, this is the closest I'm going to get to actual proof. But there was one of the French revolutionaries. He's a little less known amongst the top, you know, most people than say Robespierre, but Camille Desmoulins was one of the big speakers. He also went to the guillotine eventually, but he would give big speeches at the Palais Royal. And he gave a big speech that led to this 3-day march that led to the Bastille. But one of his hangouts was in the Palais Royal at the Café Foy. And there was a chess club above the Café Foy, which they're pretty sure that Jefferson attended. But at Monticello, archaeologists came across this this little jar, and it identified the address of the apothecary where it came from, and it was across from the Café Foy. And they think that that jar, since it was found in a pit near the enslaved housing quarters that they believe where Sally had lived, it's like, oh my God. So she probably saw Camille Desmoulins give speeches. She was there while all of these revolutionaries were giving speeches. She and James were there while all this was going down. And so that's really exciting. You know, they were there in these revolutionary times. They could have stayed. They could have claimed their freedom. But they had also lived through the American Revolution. They had been Sally herself had been a child when Tarleton's forces had marched up Monticello. And, you know, even though most African Americans, especially in Virginia, had a better chance of freedom with the British, a lot of it has to do what is your personal interaction with them. And the British had been very intimidating with those people at Monticello. They also, her encounters with a lot of the revolutions was very dangerous and very, you know, you didn't know which way it was going to go. And at the end of it all, I mean, I'm pretty sure that a lot of the enslaved people who had been in Richmond with, and in Williamsburg and Richmond with Thomas Jefferson actually chose to go with the British. And when they came back, they had seen a lot of terrible things at Yorktown. There had been at one of his properties, the British absconded, he said later on, with several of his enslaved people there. And when they were returned, you know, they were returned and they came back with smallpox. So there were a lot of terrible stories that came out of, you know, who could you trust with freedom? Freedom promised and taken, freedom promised by the person who holds you as property. So what could they believe out of revolutionaries? And then what were they going to do leaving their whole extended family behind to be in a country that is alien that sees you as alien, that you can't necessarily trust. I think they were, they wouldn't have threatened to stay if they weren't fully prepared to stay. But when I started looking at it, I started thinking, what was their end game? They were willing to stay to get their freedom, you know, to be free. But did they really intend to stay in France and be free? Wouldn't they have just picked everything up and gone rather than go to Jefferson and say, hey, we're going to go and be free here in France? So I think with James wanted to, they wanted freedom, but they wanted freedom in America or security in America. And so James, even though the documents come later in Philadelphia, and there's a whole reason that I won't get into here, why I think that it was documented in Philadelphia, but the bargain took place in France, was that he wanted his freedom, but he wanted it in America. And she wanted to have freedom in the future. I mean, it would be nice if she had her own freedom, but it would be nice to have, you know, what kind of bargains can she make? What kind of future is she going to have as a domestic? So her children's freedom in the future. And it's not a perfect thing, but it's a better thing.
There's also an LA angle to this story in the sense that
yes,
Frederick Madison Roberts, the first black man elected to the California Assembly representing black LA in 1919, was a great grandson of Sally Hemings. And of course, that leads us to Madison Hemings. Who was he?
Yes.
And what was the importance of his memoir to your story?
Well, Madison, and Madison's another one I fell in love with. Madison is Sally Hemings' second youngest son with Thomas Jefferson. And he's the one who did not cross the color line. Now, there's seven children with Jefferson, but four of them lived to adulthood, past infancy. The oldest was Beverly, and the next one, Harriet. They reached age 21 before Thomas Jefferson died. So they left the plantation. They ran off, as it said in the farm book. That's Jefferson's recording of all of his enslaved people in his farm book. The language just makes her head explode. But they passed over the color line. In fact, trying to find their descendants, trying to find Harriet, was she changed her first name. She got married. Her last name, Madison said, last he heard, she was married to a well-off white man, and nobody had any idea about her African ancestry. Then Esten and Madison, who were younger, they trained to be carpenters with their uncle, John Hemings. And they were the ones who are mentioned in Jefferson's will and are kind of in a roundabout way freed in his will. Esten later moved to Wisconsin and crossed the color line, but Madison did not. And Madison was found by a census taker who put in the census. You can even look this up on Ancestry, who said, this man is the son of Thomas Jefferson, who notified a friend of his who was a reporter who went and interviewed Madison. And Madison gave this whole story about going back to, I love the way he put it, he called, this is a story that's handed down to me. And he told about the African woman who was his, Sally Hemings's grandmother, about Elizabeth Hemings, who was kind of the matriarch of all of these Hemings, this huge Hemings family, of his mother and this story about his mother and his father in Paris. And then, you know, and what this bargain was for him and his siblings' freedom if she would go back and be his father's concubine. And concubine being the word they used for providing sexual services in exchange for what he called it extraordinary privileges and the freedom of the children when they reached 21. And he gives all of these clues, these insights, and also the way he tells a story, that when people tell their family stories, they tell it giving this kind of intention of what is the value of their family. That the way I read it was that there was this freedom that was taken from this African woman and then taken away from Elizabeth Hemings when her father, Captain Hemings, tried to take her away from the man who had enslaved her. And now his mother had provided this avenue to reverse that story and make her descendants free. And so there's this constant, you know, valuing of freedom through this story that that seemed to me this value that was the message that Sally Hemings passed down to her children, because the there's no voice of hers left in any record, which is what's so hard to write a biography about someone who has no voice left in any record. And so this is the closest to her that we get, is this story that she told her children, that her son, now in his old age in the 1870s, tells to this reporter. And there's even, you can go drive yourself nuts thinking of all the contingencies in that, but that's the closest there is to it. And that he preserved it and shared it with us, it's just is something really we have to be grateful about.
Grateful indeed, Professor Lee Faughton, Associate Professor of History at Lemoyne College in Syracuse, author of the book Sally Hemings, Given Her Time. Thank you for joining us on Freedom Now, KPFK, Los Angeles.
Thank you.
And up next, we will hear from political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal read his message of solidarity to water defenders by Leonard Peltier.
Message of solidarity to water defenders. Greetings, sisters and brothers. I've been asked to write a solidarity statement to everyone about the Camp of the Sacred Stones on Standing Rock. Thank you for this great honor. I must admit, it is very difficult for me to even begin this statement, as my eyes get so blurred from tears, and my heart swells with pride as chills run up and down my neck and back. I'm so proud of all of you young people and others there. I'm grateful to have survived to see the rebirth of the united and undefeated Sioux Nation at Standing Rock in the resistance to the poisonous pipelines that threaten the life source of the Missouri and Mississippi rivers. It is an honor to have been alive to see this happen with you young people. You are nothing but awesome in my eyes. It has been a long, hard road, these 40 years of being caged by an inhuman system for a crime I did not commit. I could not have survived physically and mentally without your support. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart and the depths of my soul for encouraging me to endure and maintain a spiritual and legal resistance. We're now coming to the end of the road, soon arriving at a destination which will at least in part be determined by you. Along the lines of what Martin Luther King said shortly before his death, I may not get there with you, but I only hope and pray that my life, and if necessary, my death, will lead my native peoples closer to the promised land. I refer here not to the promised land of the Christian Bible, but to the modest promises of the treaties our ancestors secured from enemies bent on their destruction. in order to enable us to survive as distinct peoples and live in a dignified manner. Our elders knew the value of written words and laws to the white man, even as they knew the lengths the invaders would go to try to get around them. Our ancestors did not benefit from these treaties, but they shrewdly and persistently negotiated the best terms they could get to protect us from wars which could only end in our destruction, no matter how courageous or effectively we fought. No, the treaties were to the benefit of the Americans. This upstart nation needed the treaties to put a veneer of legitimacy on its conquest of the land and its rebellion against its own countrymen and king. It should be remembered that Standing Rock was the site of the 1974 conference of the international indigenous movements that spread throughout the Americas and beyond. The starting point for the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, the UNDRIP, was resisted by the United States for three decades until its adoption by the UN in 2007. The U.S. was one of just four nations to vote against ratification, with President Obama acknowledging the declaration as an aspirational document without binding force under international law. While some of the leaders of this movement are veterans of the 1970s resistance at Pine Ridge, they share the wisdom of our past elders in perceiving the moral and political symbolism of peaceful protest today is as necessary for us as it was necessary for the people of Pine Ridge in the 1970s. The 71-day occupation of Wounded Knee ended with an agreement to investigate human rights and treaty abuses. That inquiry and promise were never implemented or honored by the United States. The Wounded Knee Agreement should be honored with a Truth and Reconciliation Commission established to thoroughly examine the U.S. government's role in the Reign of Terror on Pine Ridge in the 1970s. This project should be coordinated with the cooperation of the many international human rights organizations that have called for my immediate and unconditional release for more than four decades. I have to caution you young people to be careful, for you are up against a very evil group of people whose only concern is to fill their pockets with even more gold and wealth. They could not care less how many of you they have to kill or bury in a prison cell. They don't care if you are a young child or an old grandmother, and you better believe they are and have been recruiting our own people to be snitches and traitors. They will look to the drunks, the addicts, and child molesters, those who prey on our old and our children. They look for the weak-minded individuals. You must remember to be very cautious about falsely accusing people based more on personal opinion than on evidence. Be smart. I call on all my supporters and allies to join the struggle at Standing Rock in the spirit of peaceful spiritual resistance and to work together to protect Onsimaka, Grandmother Earth. I also call upon my supporters and all people who share this earth to join together to insist that the U.S. complies with and honors the provisions of international law as expressed in the UNDRIP, International Human Rights Treaties, and the long-neglected treaties and trust agreements with the Sioux Nation. I particularly appeal to Jill Stein and the Green Parties of the U.S. and the world to join this struggle by calling for my release and adopting the UNDRIP as the new legal framework for relations with indigenous peoples. Finally, I also urge my supporters to immediately and urgently call upon President Obama to grant my petition for clemency, to permit me to live my final years on the Turtle Mountain Reservation. Scholars, political grassroots leaders, humanitarians, and Nobel Peace laureates have demanded my release for more than four decades. My clemency petition asks President Obama to commute or end my prison term now, in order for our nations to make progress healing its fractured relations with Native communities by facing and addressing the injustices of the past. Together, we can build a better future for our children and our children's children. Again, my heartfelt thanks to all of you for working together to protect the water. Water is life. In the spirit of Crazy Horse, Leonard Peltier. You've been listening to the words of Leonard Peltier, which have appeared in the newly published book, Beneath the Mountain. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
For KPFK Pacifica Radio Los Angeles, this is Gerald Horn, and with me on the line is Erica Denise Edwards, Associate Professor of History at the University of Texas at El Paso, and author of the book Hiding in Plain Sight, Black Women, the Law, and the Making of a White Argentine Republic. Thank you for joining us on Freedom Now, KPFK Radio Los Angeles, Professor Edwards.
Thank you for this opportunity and this ability to continue to talk about my book and overall my research about whitening in Argentina.
Fantastic. So why did you produce this book?
Various reasons, but the biggest one was, or the most influential, was my ability to study abroad as an undergraduate. And I was only 21 at the time, and I went there not knowing much about the country at all, which I don't recommend. But once there, I was in total shock that I did not find someone who looked phenotypically like myself, or as I would describe a Black person, what we would see as a Black person in the United States. So that began my inquiry into what happened to this Black population, learning in history classes that slavery existed in all throughout all of the Americas. So that really kept things going. Returned to graduate school, pursuing that conversation, and various trips. So many, filled up a passport going back to Argentina. Just continued to perk my interests and in learning of the great work that had been previously done, and then seeing where the gaps needed to be filled.
So how did you learn Spanish?
I learned Spanish, actually. It was my minor in college, but really it was that first trip in Argentina. So I still speak today with what they call a porteño accent because of my first opportunity to hear native speakers were Argentines that lived in Buenos Aires. Mm-hmm. So it's been a journey.
So There were a significant number of black people in Argentina at the beginning of the 19th century, not so much at the beginning of the 20th century. What happened?
The great question, right? What took place? And for those of us that are historians, a lot of these answers were provided for as early as during the 1980s or so, where we can kind of whittle it down to a few things. The biggest one is we see that there is a decline overall after the end of the slave trade. So we're not going to have Africans coming into what was called the Rio de la Plata at that time after 1812. We will also start to see that there's a question of modernity and how we move forward and become a quote-unquote modern nation. This is not unique to Argentina. This happens through all of the Americas, specifically what we would consider Latin America today, which is they saw Europe as a model to follow. And one of the things that they thought were, well, in order to be one of the progressive countries, we want that intellect, we want that work ethic, we want quote-unquote whiteness, which was very much equivalent to this sense of progression as well as civilization. So throughout all the Americas, we see this taking place, but Argentina in many ways is the success story. And it's a little thing that the government will start to do. One thing that we know for a fact as historians is by roughly about the 1850s, they will no longer note race in the majority of their official documentation, the census records. So already we will see a decline there in terms of how people will be represented. Instead, we'll see what were formerly noted as being negro or negra or mulata shift to other categories, racial categories. So that's also part of what we would call invisibility. In Argentina as well, to Argentina as well, is this European immigration was quote unquote the success story, right? Or today they say jokingly at times that an Argentine is an Italian who speaks Spanish but wants to be British. So very much outside of and unique to the rest of Latin America. These numbers literally whitewashed the landscape and the demography. And there's no doubt about that, right? So, you know, just simple math. You bring in, you have 10 people, let's even go like this, 10 people and half of them, let's say by the mid-19th century, are black. So 50%, again, just a simple math equation. And then you bring in 100 white people from different European countries. That's another way that they disappear, right? So I'm not even talking about physically anything happening to them. I'm talking about what we again call as historians and social scientists, blancamiento, or the whitening process. And so these already were in effect. And these are external influences. So what happens to a black population that is seeing this shift, right, in terms of the government, in terms of culture, is they too, when they could, also whiten themselves. So you have those that would shift over to different racial categories. You have others that will reject their blackness and only affiliate with other white people, becoming very Europeanized. And there's a very clear class conflict in the black newspapers in Argentina that show those that were of usted, meaning of the polite you and of elite, and those of che, like che or vos, right? Which is kind of like the working class. So there's a division there that it, in many ways was never united to create a united front. And these are all some of the things that we know of as historians that continued to ultimately whitewash in many ways the black population.
And so you address the role of women in this whitening process, for example, through honor, dress, education. How so?
Well, what I wanted to do, again, filling those gaps, was one of the myths, or I'll just be more specific, lies, that often comes about is miscegenation, right? There's no more black men. They were all killed off in the wars. And I promise you, to this day, there are people that still believe that, even though we now know it's actually desertion, right? That actually affected the numbers. But still, so they say that they're all dead, quote unquote. But she now has no choice. So now she's going to ultimately either marry and or cohabitate with these white European men, and that's the end of the story. And I just found, as a black woman, that to be so problematic and insulting in many ways. And so to fill a gap within Afro-Argentine history was, one, to make her the protagonist in this conversation piece. And then two, shift it from Buenos Aires to Cordoba. And there, I was very happy to find, because it was such a small city, I could see her and follow her throughout her life. So when she's born, to when she has kids, to when she's buying property, when she's at times buying even other slaves, I could keep finding her throughout the census data and baptismal records, death records, and a bunch of notarial records. And through that process, that's where I found her to be, in many ways, strategic and magnificent in how she ultimately dealt with these limitations that were brought on her because of her status. And so, being honorable, right? Presenting yourself as a lady, trying to project yourself in a different manner, right? To show that you are equivalent to, or attempt to be and emulate senoras or Spanish women, at times brought you levels of privilege and status. So much so, at times, they would manipulate and use the law to their advantage, especially those that we would define as being racially ambiguous today, to claim other racial categories. So sometimes they would claim to be white, sometimes they would claim to be indigenous. And it's that process that I found her ability to navigate and seek not only a better life for herself, but always in a collective sense for her family, as being the most interesting shock for me. Another way that they were able to do this too, is especially if they had, when they had children, they could manipulate, I don't know how, but they would find a way to put the child in the book of Spanish baptisms versus the book of Astas or Indias or everyone else. They were segregated. So you had a book for white people that were baptized and a book for everybody else. So if you could put your daughter or your son, who at the time may be phenotypically looking white, in that book of Spanish baptisms, that was another way that mothers, right, found the ability to create a better life for their children. And so it was a very interesting find. Nothing to the effect of "I'm black and I'm proud." That wasn't happening. Especially at that time, and especially in such a conservative city. So I ultimately found, through, you know, assessing over 600 court cases, oh my goodness, thousands of notarial records, is that these women ultimately acted upon the choices that were given to them. And so if you think about the late 18th century, you're a mom and you recognize that there is, for example, a threat of enslavement. One of the things that women actually did was then claim that they were indigenous, using law that would have been on the books for hundreds of years to gain that freedom. Or if you want to marry, as I found, very interesting. And this was something that the Catholic Church allowed, okay? And that's very different than the United States experiences, in that the church allowed people to marry. So we would have not often, but we still had instances where enslaved women would marry white men. Okay. In my case, for the entire century of the 18th century, we only know of 6 that did it. But still, that's quite profound when you think of it in comparison to the United States. Laws would come about to prevent this because, oh my goodness, I guess 6 is too much, right? And so now you had to proclaim, for example, that you are equal to your fiancé, a white man, in order to marry. If not, the parents could prohibit you from getting married. They did have a little caveat, which is why I love this chapter that I wrote about, in which if, however, the couple can prove that they are of equal merit, then, and in love also, they can then go ahead and get married. Well, lo and behold, there are a lot of couples that I guess found that it was worth fighting for. I had over 150 cases, right, of just that, those appeals. And then separating those from black men who were considered to be less than white women, I had about 90 or so that were fully complete and involved women being accused of being black. What amazed me is that when I looked at the results, it was basically 48-52. 52 in favor of the couple actually getting married, 48 saying no. Now, this as a historian is what makes it fascinating, because we've known those results. So this is why we always have to remind ourselves, even though the quote unquote facts are available and the data is available, interpretation can continue to provide us with new understandings of the past. And that's what I did. I went back, I reread all of the actual arguments put forth by these women. And that's when I found those that could successfully argue that they were either white or indigenous were able then to get married. So again, all the strategies are showing me that unintentionally, she is contributing to what will eventually be a white republic. She's strategic, she's an intellectual, she's a black woman. And I'm not surprised at all at what I found.
Mm-hmm. Finally, Professor Edwards, author of the book Hiding in Plain Sight, Black Women, the Law and the Making of a White Argentine Republic, to what extent are your findings about Córdoba generalized to the Americas, even to the United States, for example?
They actually are very indicative of other small towns, and especially small towns in what we would call the periphery of the African diaspora. So if we look beyond the U.S. South, we look beyond primarily the Caribbean, the Brazil, Guyana, Colombia, but if we kind of look at more of like the Canada, what would we could say the northern states, the frontiers on down, it is very indicative of how they functioned, in that there is the lack of oversight, immediate oversight, because they're often forgotten places that don't have, you know, the luxury or the gold, such as Mexico City, right, or Lima. So there's more of a flexibility that can take place, a manipulation of the law that I found that can often take place because you don't have the immediate oversight of kind of the more prestigious and or powerful agents of the law there. So I think it's a very common conversation of how people can use these jurisdictions when they could use these jurisdictions to help themselves in an individualistic manner. I found with her, it was always somehow leaning towards not just her, but her family. So it's a very collective conversation. And I think in general, that's something that you can find with most women as well. This is a different strategy that is often not individualistic in the terms of how you could see it as a masculine vibe, or a masculine avenue, right, to freedom. She's always thinking of and being more of a collective, not even conversation, but strategy towards moving her family to a better position. And I think that would be very also another common trait throughout the Americas as well.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, Erica Denise Edwards, Associate Professor of History at the University of Texas at El Paso, author of the book Hiding in Plain Sight, Black Women, the Law, and the Making of a White Argentine Republic. Thank you for joining us on Freedom Now, KPFK, Los Angeles.
Thank you so much for having me.
And in closing, we'd like to thank our guests, Erica Denise Edwards, Lee Fott. Thank you to our producers, Dr. Gerald Horn, Sister Flora, Sister Fanny, Brother Brandon. Thank you, Abort Up Wendell, and all those who made today's program possible. Signing off with Rita Mao, this is Sister Thage, and until next week, as always, we stand ready for revolution.